We're going to be speaking tonight about the Iranian nuclear program, which is an issue that's kind of been on the back burner in conversations about Iran due to the last 6 weeks of protests that have drawn a lot of attention there. But the issue, the nuclear issue, continues to build. The centrifuges continue to spin. And I think it's fair to say that the issue is coming to a head. We are increasingly reaching decision points that I don't think anybody wants to be at. Our guest tonight is Kelsey Davenport, Director for Nonproliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association, where she focuses on the nuclear and missile programs in Iran, North Korea, India, and Pakistan, and on international efforts to prevent proliferation and nuclear terrorism. So, Kelsey, welcome. And to start off, you know, just to give us some context for those in the audience who might not follow this stuff every day, because it is a pretty technical issue, what is the baseline for good safeguards on nuclear programs, on things like the production of enriched uranium and so forth? And how does that compare to the safeguards that are currently on Iran's nuclear program?
Well, thanks so much, John, for having me tonight. It's really great to be with all of you, and I'm looking forward to the discussion. So getting back to your question on safeguards, safeguards are really designed for countries that do not possess nuclear weapons, but have nuclear programs to ensure that those nuclear programs are entirely peaceful. Now, all states that are party to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, but don't possess weapons, so the vast majority of the world, are required to implement what's known as a comprehensive safeguards agreement. And that gives the International Atomic Energy Agency access to sites in a country that where nuclear materials are present. So any reactors, any uranium enrichment facilities, any plutonium separation facilities. And inspectors can visit these sites. They can look at information from a country's nuclear program to try to ensure that all of the nuclear material in that program remains in peaceful purposes. So that's really what a comprehensive safeguards agreement is. It's legally required for all NPT member states. You know, but in the 1990s, it became clear that CSAs were really insufficient in terms of actually providing assurance that states weren't engaged in illicit nuclear activities. You know, the experience with Iraq, the experience with North Korea, you know, demonstrated some real shortcomings with comprehensive safeguards agreements. So the International Atomic Energy Agency's member states worked on what's now known as the Additional Protocol. And the Additional Protocol expands the number of sites that IAEA inspectors can access. Under an Additional Protocol, they can go to facilities that support a country's nuclear program but don't have nuclear materials present. So, you know, where you might mine uranium, for instance, or, you know, a facility that produces centrifuges that then are transferred to an enrichment facility. So that gives the IAEA a much clearer picture of a country's nuclear program and provides those additional tools to ensure that nuclear material isn't being diverted for weapons programs. Unfortunately, though, the additional protocol is not legally required. It certainly has become the norm. I think of about, you know, the 180 countries that, you know, have comprehensive safeguards agreements with the IAEA. You know, I think about 135 of them or so have additional protocols. So it's definitely normative. But again, it's not required. And currently, right now, Iran is only implementing that comprehensive safeguards agreement. You know, as part of the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, it had been required to implement an additional protocol, but it halted that implementation in February of 2021. So right now, you know, inspectors have more limited access. You know, they are visiting the most concerning sites, you know, where Iran is enriching uranium, but that access isn't as regular. So unfortunately, the monitoring is much more minimal than it was, you know, prior to February of 2021.
Yeah, and you know, what, just to give folks kind of a tour of the nuclear sites, you know, what are the major sites that draw a lot of international attention that folks are concerned about? Like, how do they fit together as a process that could potentially lead toward nuclear weapons?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Iran really has on the uranium enrichment side, a whole range of capabilities that could be used for both the production of uranium for fueling reactors, legitimate civil purposes. But that same suite of technology could also be used to enrich uranium up to weapons grade. So Iran has uranium mines. That's where it's actually digging the uranium ore out of the earth. It has conversion facilities. That's where it's taking uranium, converting it into gas. And then it has enrichment facilities. It's two enrichment facilities on Natanz and Fordo. These are the locations in Iran's nuclear program that are most often in the news, because that's where Iran is actually concentrating uranium-235, which is the isotope of uranium that's fissionable, that can be used to sustain that reaction. So those are the enrichment facilities. Now, if Iran, were to pursue, a nuclear weapon, it would need to, convert the uranium gas, into a solid form. It would need to convert it into metal. And Iran is beginning to experiment, with uranium metal. But, from sort of a fuel cycle perspective on the uranium production, those are sort of the main areas where that uranium is present. And then, some of the areas, the facilities where inspectors no longer have access to, those are areas like the centrifuge component workshops, where Iran actually makes the different components and assembles its centrifuges. Iran does have several reactors. It has a research reactor, the Tehran Research Reactor, that's used to produce medical isotopes. It has a civil nuclear power reactor, Bushehr. Inspectors are certainly present at those sites. And it has a reactor under construction, Iraq. Now, technically, Iran could try to take plutonium from the spent fuel at those reactors and use that to build a nuclear weapon. But Iran does not have any plutonium separation facilities. And so that really poses less of a risk right now when you actually think about more immediate proliferation concerns.
Yeah, and so, just to zoom out on that whole process that they've got, do you think that they are pursuing a nuclear weapon? How close are they, kind of regardless of whether they are, how close are they if they chose to?
Well, I'm going to tackle the how close are they first, because that's a little easier to look at from a technical perspective than trying to, assess intentions. I mean, right now, Iran is closer to nuclear weapons than they ever have been in their entire history. Now, there's a term that's frequently used when discussing how quickly a country could move to nuclear weapons, and that term is called breakout. And breakout generally means how quickly could a country produce enough weapons-grade material for a bomb. It does not mean how long does it take them to build a bomb. It's just about producing that material. And, right now, Iran could produce enough weapons-grade material for a nuclear weapon. That's measured at about 25 kilograms of uranium enriched to 90% in less than a week. And this really is unprecedented from a risk perspective. When the nuclear deal was negotiated in 2013, it would have taken Iran 2 to 3 months. When the nuclear deal was fully implemented, that timeframe would have been 12 months. So you can really see how the risk has changed from a breakout perspective since May of 2019, when Iran began to violate its nuclear obligations in response to the U.S. withdrawal. Now, once Iran has produced that material, it would then have to weaponize it. And that's a little bit more of a wild card in terms of assessing timeframes. Israeli military officials have come out and said, probably 1 to 2 years. There are some experts who think they could do it in a year or slightly less. But the problem with that stage, that weaponization stage, is that Iran would likely take the material for a bomb, it would move it to an undeclared site, and detecting and deterring and disrupting that weaponization process would be much more difficult. So even though Iran would still be, say, a year from producing a nuclear weapon if it made the decision to do so today, the best chance to disrupt that process is during the fissile material production phase. And right now, you know, since Iran could do that and, you know, in less than 7 days, it raises questions, you know, first, would we necessarily detect Iran's breakout? And then two, would we actually be able to respond, you know, if Iran were to take that material and move it to a covert facility? So that, I think, then comes to the second part of the question is, you know, does Iran actually intend to pursue nuclear weapons? And then I don't see any indications in Tehran that a decision has been made to build nuclear weapons at this time. And in U.S. intelligence has consistently assessed over the past several years that Iran is not yet undertaking the key weaponization-related activities that would be necessary to build a bomb. You know, that being said, I think particularly right now, given the geopolitical situation, both in Iran and globally, you know, Iran's cost-benefit analysis that's going to guide its nuclear weapons decision-making, you know, could change quite quickly. You know, if the Islamic Republic, you know, were to truly believe that its regime was under threat, you know, would it view building nuclear weapons as a possible safeguard to preserving the regime? You know, that's what North Korea does in part to preserve the Kim regime. You know, would it see a nuclear deterrent as enabling, you know, more aggression in the region and shielding it from reprisal, you know, something we've seen Russia doing now in relation to Ukraine? So I don't think that there has been a decision to pursue nuclear weapons, but I think, you know, we cannot assume that Iran would not make that decision down the road, which is why I think trying to curb their nuclear program right now is really so critical.
Yeah, and you know, what do you think of like some of the other peripheral activities that folks have talked about in the past around the nuclear program that, you know, there have been suggestions that, you know, for instance, they were working on a lot of secondary technologies that could help them build a nuclear weapon, you know, all the talk of like exploding bridge wire detonators and, you know, some of these tools that could be helpful for that. You know, and there's been allegations, you know, the Israelis pulled a bunch of documents out that they say show a pretty clear intention, at least in the past, to weaponize. You know, what do you make of that? Because like folks who are more pessimistic on this say, you know, it's almost like they're building all the components of a bicycle and building bicycle wheels and, you know, building a helmet and all this. But, you know, you ask them if they're going to build a bicycle and put it all together, and they say, well, I don't know yet. You know, that a lot of folks say, well, they're clearly building a bicycle. What do you make of some of these dimensions around that core enrichment pathway?
Well, I think Iran is certainly trying to preserve its options, or at least, you know, factions within the Iranian government are interested in preserving the option for a nuclear weapons program down the road. Because again, you know, Iran's decision making is going to be, it's going to be, you know, determined kind of by that cost benefit analysis. Now, from information that the IAEA has obtained, you know, some of it decades ago, some of it dating back to 2018, the documents you mentioned that Israel stole from Iran, you know, all of that, I think, clearly demonstrates that Iran had an organized nuclear weapons program up until 2003. That they were engaged in a range of activities related to actually building the explosive package for a bomb, to, you know, how they would pair that and fit it under the tip of a ballistic missile, and that some of those activities continued through 2009. But there is, you know, evidence from the IAEA, you know, or the U.S. intelligence community that any of those weaponization-related activities have continued since 2009. So I think there's fairly strong evidence that there's no current weaponization program going on. But if you look at how Iran approached negotiations, you know, in the JCPOA, you know, they were adamant about preserving their ability to enrich uranium. Now, of course, the justification was that, you know, we need to be able to fuel our own reactors. We can't count on international suppliers. They're unreliable. But I think there was certainly an element of nuclear hedging too. You know, again, factions wanted to preserve that capability to pursue nuclear weapons if the security calculus changed down the road. So I think, you know, in order to prevent Iran from pursuing nuclear weapons in the future, you know, we can't just look at restraining the nuclear program, because based on the research they have done, based on how advanced their nuclear program is, I mean, Iran could build a nuclear weapon if they want to. They have the knowledge, they have the capabilities. You can't put that genie back into its box. So, you know, restrain the program, but also try to look at how you can address Iran's cost-benefit analysis in nuclear decision-making. You know, drive up the costs of pursuing nuclear weapons. You know, reduce the the security benefits or perceived security benefits of the bomb. And I think the 2015 nuclear deal sought to do that in part by reintegrating Iran into the global nuclear economy, you know, demonstrating the economic benefits of being a responsible nuclear actor. But unfortunately, you know, because of the U.S. withdrawal and reimposition of sanctions, and, you know, now the escalation that we're seeing as Iran ratchets up its nuclear program and the U.S. imposes more centrifuges, you know, it's clear that, you know, some of the intended benefits there, you know, haven't really played out yet, and unfortunately may not be available in the future.
Yeah, just to stay on the nuclear deal, what exactly was in it? Like, how did it change the Iranian nuclear program and the safeguards on it when it was in full force?
Sure. So from a nonproliferation perspective, the 2015 nuclear deal was really quite remarkable. I mean, it was proved to be a strong and effective deal, you know, during the, you know, the 3+ years that Iran implemented it fully. And that's in part because it was so comprehensive. You know, I mentioned earlier Iran's ability to break out, that, you know, currently it's about a week under the JCPOA. When it was fully implemented, that was about 12 months. And that's because the deal put in place very intrusive or very strict limitations on Iran's uranium enrichment program. It limited the enrichment level that Iran could pursue. It limited the stockpile of enriched uranium Iran could keep on hand. And it limited the number of centrifuges that Iran could have operating to actually enrich that uranium. So together, that really expanded that breakout time period to a year. The JCPOA also included the most intrusive monitoring regime ever negotiated. Iran had to implement the additional protocol to its safeguards agreement, in addition to that legally required comprehensive safeguards agreement. But monitoring went even beyond that. There were facilities and sites in Iran that were under continuous surveillance under the JCPOA. You know, inspectors could also access those enrichment sites, Natanz and Fordow, you know, on a daily basis if necessary, if they wanted to. And Iran's enrichment was actually monitored in real time using a machine called an Olam. So really intrusive monitoring designed to almost immediately detect, you know, any diversion by Iran at any level, you know, of that supply chain, from mining the uranium ore to actually enriching it. And then also, you know, although the plutonium pathway to nuclear weapons, you know, wasn't nearly as immediate of a risk, you know, when the JCPOA was negotiated, you know, the provisions related to plutonium are also very strong. I mean, Iran had to, you know, ship out the spent fuel from its reactors at Bushehr and the Tehran Research Reactor. And it had to modify the reactor that's under construction in Iran, the Arak reactor, to ensure that it would produce significantly less plutonium than what would be necessary for a bomb on a yearly basis. So also really strong on the plutonium route too. You know, I would also note that whenever Iran wanted to purchase dual use items, so these are materials that could be used for its nuclear program, you know, those were subject to review by a procurement channel set up in connection with the UN Security Council. And essentially, you know, members of the JCPOA could vote as to whether or not Iran would be able to purchase those items. So even Iran's imports of technology and materials relevant to its nuclear program were monitored.
And so we have a question from the audience, kind of drawing attention, I think, to both this monitoring and to, you know, kind of the status of the nuclear program. Says, hasn't the sentence "they're closer than ever" been used for the past decade? You know, which I guess you could take one of two ways, like they keep on getting closer, or the other is they keep on not getting there. And then they also ask, how does incentivizing them help monitoring if we don't know all the facilities that they have? So I guess, you know, it's a question about like, hey, you know, we know about these declared facilities. How confident can we be that there aren't undeclared facilities, given that both Natanz and Fordow were initially undeclared facilities?
Sure. So looking at, I think the first part of that question, which I started thinking about the second part, and then I forgot the first part of the question. I'm sorry. Yeah, so
saying, you know, they're closer than ever, and I think I'm not sure if the questioner meant, and they keep not getting there, or they keep on getting closer. You know, is this ever really going to stop?
Yeah. So I think, you know, if you look at kind of Iran's nuclear history, you know, there are periods where the program has been, you know, set back, you know, most notably when Iran was implementing the 2015 nuclear deal. At that point, they were further from a nuclear weapon, and it would have taken them longer to produce a nuclear weapon than before the deal was implemented. So, you know, during that period, you know, from a non-proliferation perspective, Iran was much further from a bomb than it is now. You know, now in terms of, you know, how close Iran is to a bomb, I mean, Iran's breakout to that first bomb is not going to get much smaller. I mean, we're kind of at the point right now where even as Iran expands its nuclear program, you know, breakout for that first bomb isn't going to drop to much below kind of the week that it's estimated at now. Where the program may become more risky and more of a security concern, though, is that breakout for that second bomb, that third bomb, that fourth bomb, those timelines are still going to drop as Iran's stockpiles of enriched uranium grow and as Iran continues to expand the number of centrifuges it's operating. And that, I think, is almost even more concerning than breakout to that first quantity, because, you know, one bomb doesn't really give you a reliable nuclear deterrent, particularly for a country like Iran that's never tested a nuclear weapon. You know, but when you have, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 nuclear weapons, you know, that's when you can actually sort of wield that nuclear deterrent, you know, for kind of security related purposes. So I think, you know, the answer is, you know, yes, you know, risk got worse. But then, you know, it was rolled back because of the JCPOA, and now again, it's getting worse. In regard to the second question about, you know, undeclared sites, I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately, no monitoring regime is ever going to be, you know, 100% foolproof. You know, no country, including Iran, is going to give inspectors, you know, carte blanche access, you know, to all of its facilities. I mean, the United States, you know, objected initially to some of the provisions under the Chemical Weapons Convention, for instance, because of concerns about, you know, inspector access. But I think, you know, when you look at the comprehensiveness of the monitoring regime on Iran, the fact that it does monitor every level of the supply chain, that inspectors can access state sites outside of the declared program, you know, within a month, which is unprecedented in the non-proliferation space. You know, I think it really does provide the highest possible assurance that any covert facility, you know, would be detected. That's, of course, you know, when that entire regime that monitoring regime was in effect, which, you know, unfortunately it's not now. But you also have to remember that the IAEA, you know, can receive intelligence, you know, from member states. So on top of what the IAEA is inspecting, you know, on top of the information that they're analyzing, any, you know, discrepancies that they're noticing and following up on, you know, if they, you know, receive intelligence from the United States, from Israel, you know, they can evaluate that and then use that, you know, as they look to, you know, follow up with Iran. So, you know, when that entire regime was in place, you know, that plus national technical means, you know, I think it does provide, you know, the strongest possible assurance that any covert sites, you know, that are operational right now, you know, would be detected.
So the other event that's been in the news related to Iran lately is these massive protests, which have been running for nearly 7 weeks now. And the Biden administration has seemingly started to suggest that they aren't going to be making restoring the nuclear deal much of a priority during this period, that they're more focused on the situation with the protests. What do you make of that? Is your read the same? Do you think that's a good strategic decision, the right kind of prioritization?
I mean, personally, I think the Biden administration needs to be, you know, walking and chewing gum at the same time. I mean, certainly it's critical to support the protesters. And I think the steps that the Biden administration has tried to take, you know, some of the licenses that they've granted for tech companies to allow, you know, greater communication amongst protesters, actions like that, you know, Biden's own words, I think go a long way in demonstrating support for the protesters. Now, the U.S. has also said quite clearly that, you know, that the nuclear talks are not a focus right now. On one hand, I think that's understandable, not so much because of the protests themselves, but because the demands that Iran is making right now in relation to the nuclear deal are completely unreasonable, and the United States has no space to negotiate them. I mean, Iran is demanding that the IAEA essentially agree in advance to close an investigation into some past nuclear activities that Iran conducted that it didn't declare to the agency, and to refrain from any future investigations. I mean, the U.S. cannot commit the IAEA to do that. And even if they could, you know, it would be extremely concerning from a non-proliferation perspective to set that precedent. So long as Iran continues those demands, you know, an agreement on the JCPOA is very unlikely. And there's no real sign that Iran is willing to relax that position. You know, could the United States try to put forward some sort of creative solution, you know, to address, you know, the IAEA investigation and Iran's demands there? I mean, I don't think, you know, I would like to see them, you know, still trying to proceed on the nuclear front, on Iran's nuclear program, you know, in some way. Because while we're in this stalemate, while we're in this impasse, you know, the risk from Iran's nuclear program is continuing to grow because the program continues to accelerate. And there's no evidence that Iran is going to, you know, halt these nuclear escalations while talks remain at an impasse. So if the Biden administration, you know, kind of continues to do nothing and wait for Iran to come back to the table, you know, we could end up in a situation where Iran's program advances beyond where the U.S. assesses that restoring the nuclear deal would still have non-proliferation benefits, you know, or that Iran's nuclear program expands into a space where either the U.S. or Israel no longer judge that the risk posed by Iran's nuclear program is tolerable. And that's when you get into, you know, the possibility of further sabotage, the possibility of military strikes. And, you know, once you cross that, you know, threshold, I think the likelihood of diplomacy is going to be dead for a while, and you really risk an escalating spiral that could unfortunately lead to conflict. So like I said, I have some empathy with why the Biden administration is not focusing on the nuclear deal right now, but I do think that they need to begin thinking about ways to stabilize the current situation, even if that's not necessarily, you know, returning to talks on the JCPOA right now.
Do you think that the Raisi administration, the administration in Iran, actually wants a deal, given that they're putting up all of these demands and, you know, the negotiators keep complaining that, like, oh, we had these issues solved and then they brought up new issues and so forth?
Well, I think that there are different factions within the Raisi administration. And I think there are individuals, there are groups that do genuinely believe that a nuclear deal is in their best interest, particularly if Raisi wants to realize some of the economic promises that he made, you know, when he was running. And I think that, you know, those individuals would settle for a deal as long as they can sell it as better than what the previous Rouhani administration would have gotten. And I think, you know, in kind of the August, September, you know, period, you know, we saw some of the tension between the factions that, you know, that want a deal and some of the factions that I think don't see any benefit in reaching a deal, either because they genuinely believe that the next U.S. president is going to withdraw from the deal, so it's not really worthwhile for Iran from an economic perspective. Or because they, you know, they don't see, you know, benefits of, you know, kind of Iran, you know, dealing with the kind of the quote unquote West, or in some cases, you know, there are factions in Iran that benefit from the U.S. sanctions regime, you know, their control and influence in the black market. So a deal does not necessarily benefit them, even though it would have economic benefits for the people of Iran writ large. So I think that ultimately, I think that the Raisi government does want a deal. I'm just not sure that they're willing to pay the price to actually get that agreement. And that's because, you know, they're, you know, if you look more at the demands about the safeguards investigation, you know, this is evidence that the IAEA has that Iran had uranium at sites, you know, prior to 2003 that it never declared to the IAEA. You know, this is not an ongoing, you know, issue. I mean, this is about the past. You know, there's no evidence that these illicit activities are ongoing today. But it's challenging for Iran to provide the IAEA with explanations that are credible for why those materials were outside of the declared nuclear program, because Iran has never admitted to any illicit nuclear activity. It's never admitted to having pursued a nuclear weapon. So admitting that it violated its safeguards agreement, that it moved, you know, uranium to these undeclared locations, you know, would run counter to the narrative that Iran has perpetuated, you know, for the past several decades, that, you know, all of this, you know, all of the evidence about its weaponization program is fabricated, that, you know, the work that it was doing, you know, was for conventional military purposes, it was for oil drilling, it wasn't for building a nuclear weapon. You cannot explain, you know, uranium at undeclared sites away in that same way. So that's why I say, you know, I think there are also elements of the Raisi government that want a deal, but they may not be willing to kind of pay that price.
Turning the other direction, you know, back to the protests a bit, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen with these protests, but suppose they lead to the collapse of the Islamic Republic. You know, what do you think happens to the nuclear program? And, you know, what would lessons would you take from other states that have experienced those kinds of political transitions, like, say, South Africa?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a really challenging question, because, you know, if, you know, the protesters succeed in overthrowing the Islamic Republic, I mean, what government comes next? I mean, based on what the people are protesting for, you know, you'd hope it would be a more democratic, a more open government. But there's no guarantee that you don't end up with something worse than the Islamic Republic, you know, right now. So I think that, you know, that there really are kind of a range of scenarios. I mean, I think you have to worry about a government that might come in, that might, you know, see what the protests had accomplished and decide that pursuing nuclear weapons would allow them to secure their regime. You know, at the same time, I think if you look at Iran's nuclear program, it really makes no sense from an economic perspective. I mean, there are, you know, enrichment consortiums that, you know, can produce nuclear fuel much more effectively, you know, much less expensively, that, you know, Iran could purchase to meet its reactor demands. So, you know, if you're building a new government that is really, you know, focused on, you know, on trying to meet the needs of the Iranian people, that is more open, that is more democratic, I think, you know, you recognize that the nuclear program is an economic weight around your neck, and that if you, you know, were to give up enrichment, then I would think that many of the restrictive U.S. sanctions targeting Iran's nuclear program, you know, would be lifted. And, you know, certainly there are, I think, you know, precedents for, you know, how you could, you know, ship out the material, how you could verify that, you know, the centrifuges are dismantled, are destroyed. And, you know, you could actually verify that this dismantlement of the nuclear program was taking place. You know, you mentioned South Africa, you know, there are verification lessons, you know, there, but, you know, other places as well. I mean, if you look at, you know, Libya, Iraq, you know, South Korea, there are certainly, you know, precedent for sort of overseeing kind of the tapering off or ending of a nuclear program.
What do you do with all those scientists that know a lot about how to do nuclear stuff and not a lot else? I think it was with the Soviets, there was a lot of concern that these guys would just go off and sell it to the highest bidder.
Yeah, and I think the U.S. rightly recognized that. And part of the cooperative threat reduction work that the U.S. did with, the former Soviet Union was ensuring that these scientists had meaningful and remunerative employment. I think, ideally that's something that, either the U.S. could look to try to do with Iran or other, European countries could do with Iran. Because, one point that I maybe should have brought up in relation to that last question, what do you do with some of these facilities? What do you do with the program? I mean, there are also a lot of, nuclear research related opportunities that, you could, funnel some of these sites, toward. I mean, the Fordow enrichment plant, for instance, under the JCPOA, Iran could not enrich uranium there. But it was working with the Russians to turn that facility into a stable isotope production facility. So again, nuclear research that would actually have greater benefit to the Iranian population. I mean, so you could foresee, perhaps keeping some of these facilities as nuclear related facilities, but changing the focus to research, away from, uranium enrichment, for instance, perhaps even, opening these up as broader, centers where scientists from other countries could come and work, could come be engaged. So I think, you raise a really important point. If you want to prevent proliferation, you cannot just think about the materials and the technologies. You have to also think about the individuals where that knowledge is stored. And their futures, if that program were to end.
So we've gotten a lot of questions in the audience about kind of a parallel dimension of your expertise around Iran's missile program. And in particular, there's been a lot of talk about Iran providing ballistic missiles to Russia that it's going to use in Ukraine, and also about some of the Iranian-made drones that have now been conducting regular attacks in Ukraine. What do you make of that development?
I mean, I think it's atrocious for several reasons. I mean, on one hand, I find it unconscionable that, Iran, a country that suffered, indiscriminate ballistic missile attacks on its own cities during the Iran-Iraq war, during that period, the international community did next to nothing to protest those attacks, would then turn around and provide Russia with the same capabilities to indiscriminately target Ukrainian cities. And I wonder if there is some shame because of that legacy that has led Iran to be so reticent about those sales, because usually Iran is not, a country to sort of shush up its military sales. I mean, also just from a practical perspective, Iran's sale of drones, and if it does go through with the missile sales, those are a very clear violation of Resolution 2231. That's the UN Security Council resolution that endorsed the JCPOA. Under that resolution, Iran cannot sell, system like missile or drone systems that, could be applicable for delivering weapons of mass destruction, without prior approval, from the Security Council. And the systems that Iran has transferred, the drones, the missiles that it is reportedly, planning to transfer, fall within that prohibited category. So Iran is also making it more difficult to restore the JCPOA. And I think it's risking that, the Europeans that are party to the JCPOA, invoke what's known as the snapback mechanism at the Security Council. And that's a mechanism essentially for restoring all of the restrictions, the UN restrictions that Iran was subject to prior to the JCPOA being negotiated. So it would reimpose UN sanctions on Iran. I don't think the Europeans are there yet, but if Iran continues to go through these sales, continues to allow Putin to escalate his war against Ukraine by indiscriminately attacking civilians, I think the question of snapback is going to continue to arise. So I really think that, you know, Iran is making a very sort of dangerous strategic calculation by trying to ally more with Russia during this period.
We've got a question from Max related to UNSC 2231. Would Iran have to stop that provision of drones and missiles in order for the United States and the Europeans to say yes to a deal restoring the JCPOA? And if that's the case, would Russia try to block a deal so that they could keep access to those weapons?
Yeah, that's a good question. So from a technical standpoint, you know, missiles and drones are not covered in the JCPOA itself. So, and Iran does not have to be in compliance with Resolution 2231 for the JCPOA to be restored. You know, that's going to be a separate deal. You know, but that's just, you know, a technical perspective. I think, you know, one of the questions right now is whether or not the United States and Europe have the political appetite to reach a deal with Iran, you know, while it's continuing to supply those arms to Russia. And certainly, you know, they could try to demand that as part of any agreement to restore the JCPOA, you know, Iran stop those transfers. Iran, you know, given its negotiating history in the past, would likely, you know, try to counter that, try to demand something in return. So I'm not sure that, you know, inserting those demands into the JCPOA talks would be successful. But I think the bigger issue is the effect that the missile and drone sales have had on, you know, the political will in Europe and in the United States to get a deal, not so much a technical aspect. And I think there was a second part of that question that I may have forgotten. Oh, would Russia try to block a deal?
Yeah. And I think this is a broader question, too. Like, some folks allege that the Russians have become a lot less cooperative since February in the format of the nuclear talks.
Yeah, that absolutely is the case. I mean, I think that, you know, if we look kind of prior to the invasion of Ukraine, not just, you know, the negotiations to restore the JCPOA, but also the negotiations on the JCPOA themselves, you know, there were moments where the Russians played a very useful and productive role in those negotiations. But, you know, after the invasion of Ukraine, at one point, Russia even tried to interject its own demands related to sanctions relief, you know, into the JCPOA discussions. That was around, you know, March of this past year. And that, in some ways, really killed a lot of the momentum, you know, in the nuclear talks. You know, I think there had been, you know, some significant kind of forward progress to a deal at that point. And Russia ultimately backed off of those demands, in part because, you know, Iran raised those demands with Russia directly. But like I said, it killed the momentum. And since then, you know, I think Russia is interested in a deal to restore the JCPOA. I mean, nuclear proliferation is not in Russia's interest. But, you know, is Moscow going to kind of go out on a limb to be helpful? You know, I don't think so. At the same time, I find it hard to believe that they would stand in the way of a deal to restore the JCPOA, you know, even if they thought that would have adverse effects on drone and missile sales. And I would think that for several reasons. I mean, first, you know, while the Security Council resolution prohibits those transfers, I mean, unfortunately, like many things in the international law space, you know, it's incredibly challenging to enforce. And you know, snapback of UN sanctions can be done for nuclear reasons, but it can't actually be done, you know, under the missile and drone sales. So, you know, if Iran were complying with the JCPOA, but still selling missiles to Russia or drones in violation of the resolution, you know, snapback does not appear to be an option, at least, you know, understanding my reading of that resolution. Also, The UN restrictions on missile and drone sales expire in October of 2023. So it's not like this is a long term that Russia would necessarily be impacted in the long term. If the war in Ukraine kind of really plays out and it really seems to see that it's going to need to continually rely on Iranian missiles. So like I said, I have a hard time seeing, Russia deciding to block a deal because again, at the heart of it, proliferation is not in Russia's interests. Like it's not in any of the countries that are part of the JCPOA's interest.
So going over to, that prospect of potentially restoring a deal and the kind of frozen status of the negotiations, there's been some speculation that maybe things could open up after the midterms, that maybe the administration didn't want to have a big national conversation about this issue to be happening right before an election, putting a lot of their candidates on the spot, et cetera, that maybe in a lame duck or in the next Congress, they would try some negotiations. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, as an optimist and as someone who sees non-proliferation value in the JCPOA, I would like to think that we're going to see a shift after the elections. But unfortunately, I really don't think that's going to be the case, particularly as long as the protests are going on. I mean, the protests, the missile or the drone sales, the possible missile sales, all of that, is putting pressure on the Biden administration not to engage with Iran right now. So that pressure, plus the fact that Iran does not seem to be willing to moderate its position on its demands related to the IAEA, it's hard to see where there's going to be, a political space opening after the election to move on the JCPOA, or some of those technical issues shifting in Iran's calculus. So like I said, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see, some creative, innovative outreach on the part of the US to try to get this deal done. I mean, a vote in Congress, might be a little bit easier after the election, but again, the protests, the drone sales, all of that also puts pressure on members of Congress, who might be, more reluctant to be perceived as enriching the Iranian regime, at this time. I mean, I think that's the wrong choice. I mean, I think that, if you look at what the Islamic Republic is doing now, both, the repression, directed at its own people, the brutal crackdown on these protests, its regional aggressions, all of that, could become far worse if Iran has a nuclear weapon. Iran could be emboldened further, both, in its domestic repression and its regional aggression, if it can use a nuclear deterrent to try to shield itself from any, third party intervention. So, I mean, it is certainly distasteful, the idea of doing a deal right now with the Islamic Republic. I empathize with the concern about providing them more money and what they would do with that. But I am more concerned about what Iran might do if it has a nuclear weapon. And I think, unfortunately, that domestic and regional and international events, are only going to drive Iran in that direction, if we don't reach some sort of diplomatic agreement to halt their program.
We've had a couple of questions about, the election after that. John, for example, asks, if there is, say, a 30% chance that Trump will be the next president, does it make sense for Iran to be serious? In other words, are they thinking, hey, this deal has been taken away from us before. It could very easily be taken away from us again. So why should we pursue it?
I still think there are benefits to Iran. I mean, right off the bat, Iran is going to be able to sell significant amounts of oil. And given the energy market right now, that's going to be serious money, going into Iran. So, you know, is it going to be some of this sustained economic growth and investment that was envisioned by the JCPOA? You know, probably not. You know, investors are certainly going to be concerned about the prospect of a Trump administration coming back into power. But I think, too, we should, you know, check our assumptions that, you know, if a Republican is elected, that they would necessarily pull out of the JCPOA. I mean, there were prominent JCPOA critics in the Trump administration who believed that, you know, we were in this deal, it's working, they didn't like it, but that withdrawing would be a mistake, and urged Trump to stay in it. And so I think that, you know, when you're in the position having to make that decision, you know, do I pull out of the JCPOA or do I, you know, stay in a deal I don't like? You know, you have to answer that question. Okay, well, what is my alternative going to be? You know, we've seen the alternative: withdraw from the deal, reimpose sanctions. And that's led us to a place where Iran's nuclear program is more advanced than ever before. And I would argue, given the U.S. relationship with Russia and China, you know, our sanctions are becoming and will continue to become less effective as a tool to try to coerce Iran back to the table. So, like I said, I understand why, if you're sitting in Tehran, you probably have to assume that a future president is going to withdraw. But I don't necessarily think that's a foregone conclusion. And I still think that the benefits Iran would receive, you know, during the rest of the Biden administration, you know, from oil sales alone, you know, would still provide some incentive to that a deal would be worthwhile.
We've got a question from Alfredo, who asks, irrespective of how you feel about the JCPOA, can you outline the strongest theoretical case for getting out of the deal as it stood in 2018? And you're free to add, you know, why you disagree with that case.
I mean, I think that one of the biggest criticisms of the JCPOA was that it's, you know, that key restrictions on Iran's nuclear program expire over time. And that is true. You know, within 15 years, a lot of the key limits on Iran's uranium enrichment program, you know, expires. That would be, what, I think January 2031, that a lot of those restrictions would start to expire. And I think there is a reason to be concerned about what happens at that point. You know, where does Iran's nuclear program, you know, go after some of those restrictions expire? So, like I said, I think there is legitimate reason to be concerned about that, you know, that kind of that nuclear future. That being said, you know, to disagree with that argument and to which I do disagree with, you know, I think you have to point out that there are provisions of the JCPOA that are permanent. The additional protocol, for instance, you know, which is, you know, much more intrusive monitoring. And, you know, the idea in negotiating the JCPOA was that it was a floor, not a ceiling, that it would be built upon in subsequent negotiations. That's generally how arms control talks works. That's the entire history of U.S.-Soviet and now U.S.-Russian arms control negotiations. You build upon subsequent agreements that expire. So, like I said, I recognize that the concern about the future of Iran's nuclear program is legitimate, but I don't see how accelerating that future to today by having no restrictions, you know, now is a better alternative.
Yeah, it's been a remarkable amount of future focus, you know, from a lot of the folks making that argument. Like, I totally agree with your assessment there. Do you think it would be possible for the United States to reach a deal with Iran on its missile capabilities, you know, maybe separate from the nuclear issue? Because I know there's been some controversy about this. I think one of Pompeo's 12 demands had been, you know, restrictions on the missile capabilities. At the same time, there's been suggestion that the Iranians perceive a restriction of their own on the length of range that they're willing to build their missiles out to.
Yeah, so looking at Iran's ballistic missile program, you know, I think it's quite clear, you know, through 2003, while, you know, Iran had an organized nuclear weapons program, that it was developing ballistic missiles with the purpose of being able to deliver a nuclear warhead. You know, since then, though, you know, the nuclear weapons program was abandoned, but the, you know, the ballistic missile program has accelerated. And if you look at Iran's objectives with its ballistic missile program, you know, it's working within that self-imposed range of 2,000 kilometers, and it's prioritizing accuracy now and cruise missiles that can that are much more effective at evading things like missile defense. You know, if you have a nuclear weapon on a ballistic missile, you don't have to be that worried about being accurate. You know, if you are wanting to, you know, deter, you know, the United States, you're going to invest in longer range systems. So to me, you know, what this development, this missile development is really about, is about countering better armed conventional adversaries in the region. Because if you look at Iran's conventional military, you look at its air force, for instance, I mean, its planes are practically falling out of the sky. Most of them were purchased prior to the Islamic Revolution in 1979. You know, it's old, it's decrepit, you know, so it's built up a ballistic missile program to deter, you know, adversaries in the region, you know, like Israel, like Saudi Arabia, like the UAE, that are purchasing extremely sophisticated conventional weaponry from the United States. So, you know, all of that is to say that I think it'd be very challenging for the United States to negotiate a deal with Iran about its missiles, because Iran's missiles aren't about the United States. They're not about responding to the United States. They're primarily used for regional security. So I think if you want a missile deal, you have to look at that through a regional context. You have to look at the capabilities of other countries in the region and see if it's possible to negotiate, you know, missile restrictions, you know, across the board. You know, maybe you have all the countries in the region agree to range restrictions or other, you know, mechanisms like that that are really regionally focused. And that's where I think you're going to see progress on missile negotiations.
Sticking with that theme, do you think that there are military and or sabotage alternatives to having, you know, a political solution to the Iranian nuclear program? Is this something that, you know, countries could either bomb their way out of or kind of kick the can down the road? You know, the Israelis have talked about mowing the lawn, you know, okay, we'll bomb them every few years to keep them from getting a bomb.
I mean, I didn't even try to kick the can down the road, but I think you end up with an Iran that, you know, really wants the can then and sees nuclear weapons as preserving its territorial integrity from future attacks. I mean, if you look at the history of attempts to set back Iran's nuclear program using kinetic action, you know, the assassination of scientists, the attacks on facilities, you know, the cyber attacks, I mean, every time Iran, you know, builds back better. It expands its nuclear activities. It fortifies and hardens its nuclear sites. You know, like I said, you may create some space in the short term, but in the longer term, I think you're just pushing Iran towards a more advanced nuclear program and ultimately to the decision that it might be better off just leaving the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, withdrawing from it, which states have a right to do. And then, you know, pursuing nuclear weapons legally or trying to, you know, pursue, you know, a covert program, trying to break out without being detected. So I don't think that that's a viable long-term strategy if you're trying to prevent a nuclear armed Iran. I mean, also, you know, you can't bomb away knowledge. You know, Iran really already has a nuclear weapons capability. I mean, the U.S. assessed, you know, back in 2007, that if Tehran were to make the decision to do so, it had the necessary technological capabilities to build a bomb. So again, you said, you know, you might, you know, be able to set back the program temporarily, but in the longer term, I think you ultimately drive Iran towards nuclear weapons and you risk those military strikes escalating into a much broader conflict, which I think, you know, the United States, you know, really cannot afford right now.
All right. Well, we've only got time for one more question. We like to ask a lot of our guests this. What advice would you give to young people who want to follow in your footsteps professionally? What's maybe one piece of advice?
You know, I think that if you are looking to pursue a career in, kind of the public policy space, really thinking about the skill set that's necessary to advance that career is important. Writing, I think, is critical. Learning to write for a broad range of interests or a broad range of audiences, learning to write, different types of publications. I think all of that is really critical and can really, set you up well to be successful. And I would also say too, just, be persistent. It can be a challenging field to break into, but one that I think really rewards, you if you're passionate about it and you'll find a way. So best of luck to anyone out there listening who's looking to go into the field.
Yeah, well, and you set up a perfect plug for our Marcellus Policy Fellowship, which is about to open applications and aims to teach people that kind of multidimensional policy advocacy writing skill set. So those of you in the audience with 0 to 2 years of experience in the foreign policy space, definitely keep an eye out for that application to go live very soon. But that's all the time we have. We've been speaking with Kelsey Davenport about the Iranian nuclear program. Thank you, Kelsey, for speaking to us. And thank you to you all for attending.
Thanks for having me.